What you're about to listen to is the first part of a very long conversation I had over two meetings on Skype with Anne Diamond, the author of My Cold War, The Man Next Door, and other self-published works. This is a very long podcast, hence I've broken it into four separate parts. It's such a rich and deep subject matter that Anne and I were exploring that there was no way to really cover it in less time than that, and in fact, we left quite a few stones unturned, I felt. So I've kept most of our conversation intact and chosen to go this route, a very long podcast. I'm tempted to apologize for that, but that would be kind of pointless. I can only encourage you to take the time to listen to all of these. I think you'll find it worthwhile. If for whatever reason you don't want to listen to all of them, I'd suggest listening to the last one, where Anne and I get into more general conversation about what it is we've been exploring, and the first one, of course, just for an introduction, what it is that we're going to be talking about. One of the main subjects that Anne and I talk about involves the notorious MKUltra program, the experiments of Ewan Cameron in Canada in the 1950s and 60s, and the sexual abuse and torture of children. Anne is a survivor of this program, and as such, what she has to recount could be upsetting for some listeners. Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Liminalist. This is The Liminalist, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the door in dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I'm walking a long way, just for another chap. And then I saw her in the crowd, and I looked her in the eyes.
I mean, you don't. You've uncovered a lot of stones and found a lot of dots to join, and you still don't have. You know, the bulk of your memory is still buried. I've really only been able to deduce my involvement in these kind of programs. I don't think I was actually taken off and to some secret school, but I think it was more of a remote kind of interference in terms of actually sort of timed and orchestrated abuse within my actual domestic environment, within, I think, is my guess. I think that I was somewhat psychically engineered and part of a whatever equivalent programs were going on in England. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. My point was is that I got very little. I don't even remember my first 7 years. So I have this sense that yes. My psyche is this minefield, and I want to step through it very, very carefully, because if a mine goes off, I want to be ready to, you know,
I'm fine.
To take the blast.
I'm fine with not remembering, and I was told more than once, don't get hypnotized.
Oh yeah,
you know, don't. I was advised enough times, two or three times, by different people that seem to have insight in different ways, you know, and they just said no. One said, you know, you've erected very effective barriers. You've been able to function. You've had it, you know, you're a functioning person, whatever you're successful at that level, you know, of not being swamped. Because I've also met people who have had the opposite, and their trigger is something, they don't necessarily go and try to find out, but something happens in their life and it triggers them, and then they're just flooded, and they never, it never stops. Right. You know, they're like shadows. I mean, I've met a couple. You know, you don't want that. Why? We can find out about it through research, you know, and then maybe gradually. Plus the fact that you write.
Yeah.
And I have read somewhere I guess it was at a survivors conference or something, where someone said the most effective, I think they thought talk therapy was very helpful.
Yeah.
The second on the list was writing.
Right.
Those are the two best strategies.
This has happened to me before. It happened with Whitley Strieber. Once I started looking into his background, it was just a vortex that pulled me in, and there were just more and more connections and more revealed. And then it happened a second time when I was writing Seen and Not Seen, and I started looking into my own family history. And the vortex that I went into wasn't the same vortex as the Strieber one, but it definitely had some of the same elements in it, and the same characters were appearing.
Really?
And this is what I sense about, or I've already seen pretty much about, the Leonard Cohen vortex, is that it overlaps in various ways already, just at first flyover. And meeting you and talking about Leonard Cohen and looking at the material, the things that you've observed and seen and put together, is very much part of, it's turning out to be very much part of an ongoing investigation that I've been doing for the last, what, two, three years now. But in the meantime, as far as talking about it in a way that will be accessible to others, I would suggest, and also for ourselves, that we start with you briefly about your background and your possible, or seems like you're pretty certain now, involvement with the experimentation that was going on in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could just tell me a little bit about that, because I don't know much about your background, and I don't know exactly how your memories or your awareness of being involved in this program developed.
Okay, we've been recording all along, is that right? There's no,
we have
there's
been
no
recording
starting,
all along.
There's no starting point.
Okay. Yeah, no.
Okay, good. It appears that, I mean, I know that I was involved in the MKUltra program, but I didn't know, and that was in my childhood, probably from the time I was born. I was even told years ago that it started before my brother and I were born. We were twins, and we were born in 1951.
Mm-hmm. Where were you born?
In Montreal.
And what was your family background?
Well, yeah, that's a whole... my father was an Air Force flight sergeant, and he was in military intelligence, but I never knew that. They don't tell you that, you know, when you're growing up. And
what did you think he was?
He was a high school music teacher,
wow.
You know, and... he, you know, taught in school, in high schools in Montreal, vocal music, you know, choirs and things. And my mother was a housewife, but she was the daughter of a French-Canadian politician. He'd been a member of the provincial legislature for about 30 years, and then he was killed in a slightly fishy train accident with a train collision in 1940. Just as the war was beginning. So my mother was the only child of a you know, I mean, they kind of were from the elite, because he was the mayor of a city in Quebec called Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu, which is now the military base. And he also was a doctor who delivered babies. He was a country doctor who went around with a horse and buggy, and then eventually a car, and, you know, was also elected to parliament, I mean, to the legislature. So he was quite a prominent person. And the school, a high school, is named after him in Saint-Jean, and also a street there. His name was Alexis Boutillier. So French Canadian, you know. And so that was my mother. My mother was the elite from the, I guess you could say the elite, but really they were simple people. He'd been promoted through the church, and I mean, he'd been selected by priests to study medicine, and that was, you know, as a young boy, and that was the start of his career. He was from a poor background, in fact, poor farming background. So both my parents had this kind of, you know, my father, meanwhile, was from a farming family community in eastern Ontario, and was there had been, I guess, you know, upwardly mobile family. Mother was very ambitious for her children. It was, you know, he was born in 1902. By the time the war broke out, he'd been a school teacher in teaching in one room schools around Ontario, but he had certain, you know, abilities. And somebody, he enlisted in the military, and in 1941, I think, and then they, being old at that time, they sent him out to British Columbia, and he was at Sea Island, and he was trained in military intelligence, and came back to Quebec in 1943, where he knocked on my mother's door. By then, she had her father had died, leaving her without really penniless, because he was he never collected bills. His patients didn't have any money during the Depression, so he was actually in debt, and left my mother with all that and the care of her elderly, arthritic mother. And they were running a rooming house down the street from the Allan Memorial, on a street called Sainte-Famille in Montreal. And one day in 1943, my father knocked on the door and asked. There was a room for rent sign, I guess, and he asked to rent a room, and met my mother, and they were both, you know, they had a lot of things in common, as it turned out, even though, you know, my father didn't speak much French, my mother spoke some English, and they fell in love, and then they married in 1944. So that's the background. Now, the thing was, my father was military intelligence then, and he'd been sent back from out from BC. He's sent to Montreal. To look for Nazi spies. How do I know this? Well, it's sort of, that's a bit tricky, but I've been told that's what he was doing. My mother was the daughter of a politician who died under slightly mysterious circumstances, and two or three other French Canadian politicians of the Liberal Party, and he was a liberal, meaning he was against the right-wing regime in Quebec at the time of Maurice Duplessis. So he'd been, he would have been, he was the type of politician that got assassinated. There was another guy called Ernest Lapointe. He had been assassinated, and they said by Nazis. So what you had then was something seemed to be going on. There were Nazis known to be operating in Montreal, Nazi sympathizers possibly. German, possibly not German, and they were assassinating enemies of the fascists, basically. And so my father may have come to it. It's likely that my father, well, that it wasn't an accident that he knocked on the door, and that he was actually interested in this case.
Right.
Now, I'm just sort of trying to. No, that's a long story, but so.
Yeah, and I got a bit puzzled about your father because, I mean, your grandfather, your mother's father, sorry, that he was a politician, but didn't you also say that he was a doctor?
He was everything. He's from a small town. He would, and the story about him was that he would work 20 hours a day every day. He didn't sleep. He'd sleep in the car while he had a driver who drove him from farm to farm where he tended the sick and delivered babies, which was the main thing was they were having babies, you know, in Quebec at that time. And he was in great demand. He was 70, and he was still working these hours. My mother said they didn't see him very much, you know. And when he wasn't doing that, he was, well, the thing was, his party during those 30 years that he was a liberal member of the legislature, never they were never once in power. So, you know, so he was a backbencher, so he didn't have much to do. But he was the member for that town. And then they elected him mayor at some point too. So, you know, I mean, I don't know. I guess they just didn't have many, I don't know, educated people. I really don't know why. So I think it's possible. I mean, I think it's likely in a way that my father went first, to investigate this family, the family of this politician, and or I don't know, could it have been coincidence? And then, they ended up getting married, and then I don't know what they did for the rest. The war then ended, and 7 years later, then they had no children for 7 years. They thought they would never have kids, and all of a sudden, my mother was pregnant with twins in 1950-51, and gave birth to us in April 51. Now, I've been told by someone who claimed years ago, I knew someone in Montreal who had been an MKUltra. He was definitely an MKUltra subject. I mean, I could talk about him. His name was Kenneth Hertz, but he was about 7 years older than me or something. He'd been born, something like that. And he was a child prodigy who was picked up by Dr. Cameron, went to McGill at the age of 10 or something. He was in university, but he wasn't really in university. He was in experiments, and they were giving him massive amounts of LSD. And he would tell me back in the 70s, in the 80s, he would tell me about that, and I would just listen, didn't make sense. And he said in 1979 or 1980, he was kind of a genius. He was a genius, had an IQ of 190 or something, and that's why they were interested in him. But they gave him so much LSD that he lost it. He became psychotic, and then he was out of the program at age 15. And then he just wandered. He became a poet, and he became the owner of a bookstore for a while, and a publisher. And he sort of did all kinds of things. He told me that he made money by designing chemistry sets when I met him in 1975, right? That's what he was doing. And he was just one of these kinds of people that, you see, on the streets. He knew everybody. Not only that, he kept detailed notes on every conversation that he ever had. I didn't know that initially, but later he showed me his notebooks where every word I'd ever said to him he had recorded. After he had a photographic memory, he would go home and write down the whole conversation he just had with you.
And how did you meet him?
I met him through a friend who lived next door to him, and she started going out with him.
So when you were adult?
When I was an adult, I was 23. It was 1975. I had moved back to Montreal. My father had just died, and I had moved back to Montreal. I was taking care of my mother, but I got an apartment downtown in 1975. There he was. Then he began coming over all the time. And he said, okay, see how I ramble, but anyway, he said to me one day in 1979, you see, the MK Ultra story had broken in 1977, the story of Dr. Cameron's secret experiments on mental patients at McGill, at the Royal Victoria Hospital in Montreal, the Allen Memorial, all of that was all one place, really. All those names are just really McGill, psychiatry. And suddenly it was international news that they had been doing these brainwashing experiments with LSD and electroshock and so on. But they were trying to limit the amount of information that was coming out on it. And he, being the kind of person he was, rabid researcher, investigator, detective, kind of busybody, had found the files at McGill University in the medical library, and he was going there daily, 1978, 79, 80, and finding his friends in the filing. Like he said, I found files, is what he said to me. I found files on all of us. They're at McGill. You want to come down and look at them. You're in there. Your brother's in there. They were experimenting on you when you were in the womb. And I just stared at him, I thought he'd gone, I said, why are you making up these stupid stories, Malicious, seemed malicious to me that... He said, we're all in there, everyone we know, kind of exaggerating a bit, but meaning people from this art scene downtown, some people who've become a little bit well-known because they were making films, like Stephen Lack and Alan Moyle and people like that. He said, we're all in there. Wow. I said, well, I never went to McGill. you know, I went to Concord. I went to Sir George Williams. My dad didn't want me to go to McGill, right? I said, I didn't go to McGill. That's ridiculous. What you, he said, you're in the files because they were experimenting on you when you were a child. And he said, they were experimenting on me. And, you know, and I just said, no, they weren't. You know, I have no memory of that. And there's no, it makes no sense. And I just said, go home, get out of here, go home, leave me alone. And at that point, he pulled out an X-Acto knife and began clicking it and threatening. So it seemed to be threatening me. He wouldn't leave. I said, I'll call the police. And he finally left at 2 in the morning or something, you know.
So this was the first
that
moment
was the first
that
time
you had.
I heard about this, but I didn't know what it was because he told me this in it was either 78, 79. It was very early on. No one knew that there were any strange twists. I said, well, nobody in my family was a mental patient. My father was in there because my father did go into the island for 6 weeks in 1962. And I went, uh-oh, but he came out. He wasn't turned into a vegetable. He had some, you know, neurological issue or something. And then he was fine after that. Well, they erased his memory. He wasn't really fine. But, you know, that's how I responded to that information. You know, I had nothing to do with anything like that. And what was it that he was suggesting that I had something to do with? And my brother and my mother, you know, who was a pregnant woman when, well, so it just, and I didn't know anyone who had any information about that. So I just dismissed it, but I never forgot it, you know.
Okay, let's take a breath, because there's an awful lot right there for anyone to digest. I didn't realize you were a twin until now. So you have a twin brother?
Well, yes, he died 3 years ago.
Oh.
Yeah, and he suffered a lot. And I would say by the end of his life, something was very wrong, you know, health, with his mind, with many things. And so he's a whole story in himself. But I'm sure, I'm convinced, I mean, I've done enough research to know now that my family were involved in these experiments through my father, his Air Force connection, Air Force intelligence. The Air Force intelligence people were the very people whose children they wanted and who most often got placed in these experiments. It was kind of a special perk.
In what way do you think that it was being sold as a perk, as in a benefit?
Because this is something, you know, I've written a whole book about it, and it really, and that's why I can just go on and on. I did a lot of research, right? So what I'm saying now is, it's all written in this book. I wrote a book called My Cold War, which I self-published about 10 years ago, where I really go in detail into all this. I can't possibly go into it all now, but basically by going back into my childhood and childhood memories, and I do have memories of being tortured on a military base. I mean, I had that memory at age 4 and tried to tell my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was in the Allen in 1962 at the very height of these MK Ultra experiments that were being done on, I mean, thousands of people, in my opinion, thousands of people passed through there and got different kinds of treatments.
When did they actually begin officially?
It began in 1953. Well, officially, MK Ultra itself was a program, and McGill University and Dr. Cameron of the Allen Memorial participated in it and got funding. But MK Ultra was basically created in Washington by Alan Dulles. He signed it into existence in 1953, March of 1953, I think it was, and it ran till 1964, which was when Dr. Cameron left Montreal. But just, you know, and I think Dr. Cameron had a very was playing quite a crucial role in the whole thing, and I think maybe his downfall also contributed at least to the downfall of the project of the MK Ultra program, they closed it down. I think Kennedy's death, Kennedy's assassination, also shook things up. That's a whole subject. But they closed it down in 64, and Cameron left Montreal. But there were many projects all over the United States and Canada. So there were 100, and I forget, it's 140 or more. Those are just the ones to know about. So,
and what year were you born?
I was born in 51, and they were already doing a precursor of those kinds of mind control experiments at McGill, involving experiments they were doing at the time involving hypnosis, drugs, various kinds of drugs. I think LSD was one of them, and for sure, and things like sodium amytal, which the truth serum, which they were experimenting with.
So, and you have a memory of at age four of being involved in some kind of abuse or torture. And you always had that memory. It didn't come back later on.
No, and the kind of document, I have a kind of documented proof of it. I'll tell you in a second. But basically, I was four when... I was 1955, 1956, which was the same year that I was basically kidnapped. Well, I was hospitalized for pneumonia at age four, and under very strange circumstances. I've been to get my records. It's, you know, this has been a whole process trying to get records for my pneumonia. I know that I've known all my life I was in the Royal Victoria Hospital, which was next to the Allen Memorial, as a child of four, that it was a big family crisis, that my mother came down to see me, but they wouldn't let me let her see me. Then she found me. I was strapped to the bed. I was delirious. I didn't recognize her. The nurse told her, well, your daughter almost died. It was a huge trauma, right? And I have fleeting memories. I have a few memories of that, but very few. Okay. At age four, and after that, I would every night imagine myself to be in an underground laboratory facility where I saw hundreds of children strapped to conveyor belts, being sexually tortured by men dressed as witches holding cattle prods while they were these long pointed objects that they applied to the children's genitals. And that's pretty bizarre, right? And I tried to tell my mother the first time, you know, when I began, I think it probably began as a memory or a dream. I don't know what it was. I mean, I was a four-year-old kid. I tried to tell my mother about this place where they were doing bad things to children, and I tried to describe it, and she said, well, that was a dream. That was a nightmare. But in order to go to sleep every night, I would make myself recreated, and I would imagine myself back there. And I did that for at least a year and probably 2 years every night.
So it helped you to sleep too?
Yeah, it brought me back. I could then sleep. I would recreate it. I would fantasize, and I would have sexual, you know, I would feel sexually excited or something too. I think that went with it, you know. And it involved this landscape, this underground landscape, which made no sense. So in 1980, I was writing short story. I started writing fiction, and my first story that I wrote was about my childhood, and it was, you know, my weird childhood where this was my fantasy at night to put myself to sleep, and I described in detail this underground facility on this what I saw, you know, and it got published, right, and then it got picked up in an anthology, and then certain people at McGill, it first got picked up in a McGill University anthology, and then I was called down, oh, we would like to meet you. All I did was submit a story to their contest, you know, and then I won. Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, it was kind of, this is going to be the lead story in our anthology, and we'd like to meet you, and blah, blah, blah. So all I could say, I guess, about that is that's the proof.
Well,
that I knew about, that I remembered it, you know, in my 20s. When I wrote the story, I was like still, I was in my 20s or 29 or something, and published it. It's in published form, so you can read it. Now, in 2002, that's when I began researching my childhood, my parents, what happened to my father, why he was put in the Allen, why they, you know, I wanted to sort of start digging, and I began the process, and I got in touch with survivors. and I began reading their accounts. MK Ultra survivors was I was led to MK Ultra, which I really had never heard of in 2002. I was 50 years old, you know, I'm corresponding and I'm reading, you know, reading, and I'm seeing this. They describe the exact same facility, the conveyor belts with the children, the electric cattle prods, and the doctors who disguise themselves as witches. The idea being that when the children talk to their parents, they would be told that they were having a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And that the whole thing, because these were psychiatrists, it was designed in that way. And it was at the beginning of a program, which we're still in now, organized sexual abuse of masses of children, is what I believe was going on. And this was the military, and I've heard it happened in California at China Lake. I don't know where I was, where this happened, but there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, I was somewhere.
Did you first read about those accounts, the descriptions?
Carol, I was a woman. It was either Carol Rutz. It was the first book or the first survivor that I started reading, and the other woman was named Cheryl something, and it'll come to me. But she had a website, and I, and there was another one. Anyway, it was in some. You know, it was. Probably the material that I first got into was from a radio series that was done out of York University or Ryerson University in Toronto. I think the station is CKLN, and they had a conference in 1998, I believe, 1997, where survivors of the MKUltra mind control and their mind control program and experiments and therapists who worked with these survivors were brought to Toronto. They gave a conference. They recorded all their talks. They transcribed them all. It was a huge source of extremely detailed information, and I think that's where I first encountered that story. Is in the in one of the testimonies, you know.
Gosh, because that hasn't really made it into the mainstream archives of information. I mean, MK Ultra has, of course, and satanic ritual abuse, even to this day, is mostly seen as, you know, as satanic panic and imaginary and so forth. It hasn't really been assimilated into the mainstream debate. So I'm surprised to hear that this was as thoroughly documented as that.
Oh, I hope that material is still available. You know, in 2002, it was, and I downloaded a lot of it, but, and I still, every now and then someone will send me an article and I'll say, yeah, I already read that. I read that back in 2002. You know, this material that when I stumbled on that, or I came across it, you know, I just happened to be off. I had been teaching, but I was, you know, my contract had ended. I had unlimited internet time. I was living in Vancouver. I would stay up all night. I could read for 12 hours straight. This material, I never connected with information in my life, you know, before, the way I connected with this stuff, and I couldn't stop. I'd read 10, 12 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I read like thousands of pages over that winter. I didn't do anything else, you know. I did a Google search at the very beginning, just out of curiosity, because I had this notion that Dr. Mengele might have worked for the Nazis. Oh, for the America, for the CIA.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'd read some book. And I just, really, it was just a flyer. It was just a kind of crazy idea that I thought, I'd like to know if, you know, anyone has looked into this. And where it took me was, the first article that came up was Allen Memorial, Montreal, 1962, Dr. Mengele reported to have been there. Well, that's when my father, you know, it was just straight to my father, because my father had been in the Allen Memorial in 1962.
Right.
You know, I mean, after that, there was no turning back. And then from there, you know, I thought, wait, I just asked about Dr. Mengele and the CIA, and I'm sort of seeing this. What I really wanted to be writing and researching was the story of my father. And it took me straight to him.
Hmm.
You know, there he's, the big mystery, what happened to him when he was in the Allen Memorial in 1962, connected with, you know, Dr. Mengele.
Was Mengele officially dead at that time, or just missing?
2002?
Oh, no, in 62.
No, he lived on. He was known. He was thought to be in Brazil,
yeah.
Argentina, Paraguay. You know, in fact, people, you know, the people who research it and so on. There are many sightings. And I have a photo. I found a photo, and I think it's of him in a Quebec City mental hospital in 1949, I think it is, which is entirely possible because he was spirited out of Italy. He got to Italy, and then the Vatican got him out to South America. Once he was in South America, I heard he just flew Pan American CIA Airlines back and forth all over the world. He came to Quebec, and you know, and the hospital where I have found a photograph, which really looks like him, he's with children, disabled children in the photo, examining a child in a wheelchair in 1949. Well, that hospital was completely, you know, controlled by the right wing of the Catholic Church in Quebec, and the Nazi sympathizing premier and all that. So, I mean, I think he wasn't. I mean, there are many reports that say he was in Quebec. It was one of his bases, you know. He could operate in Quebec.
So just coming back to a point that we didn't finish about your father being involved with this and Air Force members giving their children over to this program as a perk. Did you mean a perk for the parents or a perk for the children themselves?
I think the line, but you know, piecing together what I remember of my childhood and the things my parents would say, and then with what I know of the other, well, of survivors that I've read about online, and also people that I knew in Montreal when I was in my 20s, I would say, I'm sure, you know, that it had something to do with being gifted. Your parents would be told, your children are gifted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we were, and you know, in certain ways we were. My brother was very musical in a kind of a, you know, special, very special way. You know, he sat down at the piano and age six, and he could play and used to play in school recitals and things like that, you know. And he couldn't read music, but he could hear and play, and you know, and I was bright, I guess. So, you know, that was, and so they thought, well, you know, these are the types of children they were interested in, and they would tell the parents, well, you know, my mother said that she'd been told that. I mean, I remember her saying to me, I always thought you would work at the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, and I think they were, where'd you get that idea? I mean, no one ever told me that, but, you know, it's just, she thought it was always my belief. And, you know, I think that parents were said, you know, your children have a very bright future. You know, we'll take them and we'll give them special psychological testing.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get them on weekends and, you know, they're going to advance.
As a result of being subjected to these treatments.
My parents would have had no idea.
What they entailed, right? Yeah.
Because we would have just, I think, you know, they would just, they were stopped at the door and they couldn't come in. And we'd be taken, we'd go down the hallway,
yeah.
Is what I understand. You know, but I don't remember that. I don't remember it. I found it out in a very odd way, but, you know, yeah, I've pieced it together.
Mm. It's almost exactly the same as what Whitley Strieber describes. disguises was a Freudian slip there, because it's all concealed, yes. In his fiction and his supposed non-fiction and his alien abduction experiences. But
I could not make sense of his book. What was it called? The alien abduction. One of them I tried to read.
Communion.
Communion. Yeah. I mean, he. It was a strange experience. I could not connect with him. I couldn't believe in it.
Right.
And yet it was very, it had a real credibility, you know. I said, this is just writing, you know.
Interesting.
But I don't know what you, I haven't read your stuff on him, and I don't know much about him.
Yeah, well, maybe later we'll go into that, because that's, as I said, it's a big rabbit hole. And,
but the
parallels are very precise in terms of him being selected for this special treatment that would develop these psychic abilities and the rest,
yes.
Of it, and being subjected to sexual torture and involvement with German doctors. And,
oh, he's written about all that.
Yeah, he's written all about it. It came out later on. It came,
yeah.
You know, after he had more or less cemented the abduction narrative in the collective conscious, in society, in the culture, he then began to disclose various other narratives which seemed to, I mean, they seemed to contradict the original one, but in his mind they were adding nuance.
Undermine it. Yeah.
His view was that the torture that he was subjected to opened his psyche to contact with this other dimension, that these other beings, these visitors, kind of rescued him. So he, to this day, he insists that that was real, that both the torture and the alien intervention were real.
Uh-huh.
But his story doesn't really hold up, and it seems much closer to a dissociation narrative that he's describing and that he's concretized and made real through the act of writing. Not to say that there aren't other beings in other dimensions and that there isn't something real there also, but essentially he's made it a lot more real than I think it was. And my sense from,
I agree with you,
my investigations is that what he was hand picked for. Not that they could have known who was going to play that role, but the role that he ended up playing, that he was engineered to play that role and to be what's the term I just discovered today, a lifetime actor, basically spreading these memes through his work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have no problem at all. That's, you know, I think that's probably right. I think you're probably right about that. As I said, I had a sense that I tried to read Communion. I had a sense of it was a phony narrative with pretty good, you know, pretty well done, you know, almost convincing, but no, you know. And I have no investment in believing or not believing in ETs. It's not because I didn't want to believe it.
Mm. Yeah, well, he doesn't describe them as ETs. I mean, he's definitely, as you said, he's more subtle and intelligent than that. And he goes deeper than that. But at the same time, he is He has become the spokesman to the non-human presence on this planet, and how it's ushering into an evolutionary new phase. And a large part of his message, actually implicit, embedded in it, is that trauma accelerates evolution. So, which presumably is what these MK Ultra programs were based on, that premise, and to some extent they may have proved it, and depending on what you think of as evolution, and obviously I don't subscribe to that idea of evolution, and the idea of developing psychic potential as somehow being ipso facto a benefit. But anyway, that's a whole kind of area of speculation I think we can get into maybe later on. I'd like to kind of stay focused on the details. So let's see, where were we? I know it's impossible for you not to jump all over the place, because of course you're piecing this together over your whole life.
And I always feel, I have to, some things I can say, well, I know them from memory. Some things I know from logic, just figuring out what must have happened.
Yeah.
Some things I know from talking, just having, when you've lived in a situation. I mean, I've known a lot of these people, and they would allude to things, but even now, it's pretty much a secret, but I could name some people that you could talk to, and they would, I think they'd corroborate, my story, but anyway, the story of the Allen Memorial having children in it who were being groomed for future careers, and I think those careers included politics, media, the arts, and it was a conscious, it was a conscious effort on the part of this, of these, whatever they were, psychiatrists, scientists, and so on, to engineer a generation, and certain kids fell into it. Quite a few died. Quite a few committed, quite a few were casualties of it.
Right.
I've lived in a community in Montreal, downtown community, for most of my life. I chose to live there because I felt good there. I met people that reminded me of myself, I felt right at home. But a lot of those people had some connection with this whole thing. There was a drug scene which I was never part of and never touched, really. Hardly touched drugs in my life, but that was part of what was going on. It was an art scene. It was a media film. There was people in journalism also, because I was a journalist for a while too. I did kind of find my way into that. And I tell you that many of the people who were kind of considered to be interesting, young experimental writers and artists and so on in Montreal in the era that I was, part of, say the 80s, had some connection to this program. They were promoted for that reason, I think. And I could give some examples. But anyway, I know, so some of the things I know, I just know because I soaked them up from my environment, and eventually all the different stories and the people eventually starts to coalesce into a picture, and MK Ultra, including Leonard Cohen being, a very important figure to that generation that I was part of.
Living under the bed, that monster. He needs to be fair, that monster. Living under the bed, that monster. He needs to be fair, monster. Monster.
Before we get to Cohen, then, how long do you think that you were in the program?
Well, you know, this is hard. My parents are not alive. If they were alive, if I could interview them, they would know. But they never told us. They hid the whole thing from us. I don't think they were hip to it. So, you know, they weren't aware until about 1962 that something was wrong. And that, you know, what seemed to be a wonderful, special, you know, situation for their children was not so special after all. It was not such a good thing. And I think they became aware. There were different things that happened, right, as I was growing up. I think there were signs that I was sexually abused. You know, something happened and, my mother took me to the doctor. And I was 8 years old and, you know, I had blood in, I woke up with blood in my panties when I was 8 years old. This was in Toronto. My mother took me to the doctor because she thought, what's going on? And there was talk that I was starting to menstruate at 8, which was very unusual in 1959, right? Mm-hmm. And so there were things like that. My little injuries, I think my brother, you know, had an injury, had a scar over his eye. I think, you know, to answer your question, I think I was in it from birth because we were chosen, right? I think I was, at age 4 put into an LSD experiment under the guise of, pneumonia episode where I almost died. That, in fact, there's no record. I didn't finish that story, but anyway, there's no record of my having had pneumonia. They just said, no, you couldn't have been here. There was no children's ward. I'm absolutely certain I was in the Royal Victoria Hospital. They said, oh, no, you couldn't have been. And then they began whispering and hiding behind columns. And, you know, and then one came out and said, well, we do have some file. We do have a file for you. But I can't really show it to you. I said, well, why not? She said, I want to help you. She said, what do you want? And I said, well, this was like a few years ago, right? I'm trying to get my file and to find out what happened to me in 1955. She said, well, it's not for pneumonia. I said, well, what could it be for? She just sort of stared at me. I said, could it be for psychiatry? And she nodded. And she pulled out a psychiatry file with my name on it from 1955. Well, you know, it was empty because they emptied all the files. Mm. When the story came out, McGill went through a frenzy of destroying patients' records because there's so much had been going on.
Mm. How do you think that your friend managed to find files at the library then if they were destroying all that?
They were destroyed over... I even know someone who worked on that. He was a male nurse and they moved him over the dumpsters, you know, he worked on the dumpsters, throwing patient files into the dumpsters. This is the guy that I met in a park a few years ago. He told me, he just started talking about his days working at the Allen Memorial and the Royal Victoria Hospital. And I asked him about that period. He said, yeah, I was there. And he said, that's when we destroyed all the files. And that was in 1979 to 1980. Mm-hmm. In 1978, they hadn't figured out what they were going to do yet. And they still had the files intact. And my friend, Kenneth Hertz, the strange genius, child prodigy, you know, MKUltra survivor, was going down and was, he may have even copied those files. But, and he was trying to tell people about them. And no one believed him. So I think it was afterwards that they would have, you know, they just would have emptied them. So my file folder, I found it, you know, psychiatry.
Yeah.
But to my conscious knowledge, I've never seen a psychiatrist in my life. I've never been to a psychiatrist, you know, but I did go to Dr. Cameron at age 4 And there's proof of it, you know.
I mean, has Cameron been implicated in doing experiments on children, or is it just... Because I've only heard about adults.
Oh, you've only heard about adults because that's the official story. But if you were to go into the material that I mentioned in those, you know, and it's hundreds and hundreds of pages of talks and, you know, detailed testimony and so on from Radio CKLN, Toronto, Ryerson University, from 1998, it's mainly about children.
Okay.
The people they gathered together were some of the women that had testified at the Clinton Commission in 1994, and they were testifying about being used as children in these mind control experiments that the CIA had been running, and they were the first people to speak openly about it. By the time they did, it was 1994, and they were no longer children. They were women of about my age, so they'd been in their 30s and 40s. And some of them had undergone therapy, and their therapists had found this sophisticated programming operating in there. You know, they coded programming, and some of them had, you know, photographic memory. They could recite documents, you know, verbatim, and they knew file numbers and project numbers and all sorts of things that later could be checked into. So these women were just sort of, they were these, I don't know what you call them, prodigies or something that suddenly surfaced in for the Clinton Commission, which wasn't really even into, it wasn't even investigating mind control, but they showed up and opened up the topic for the first time.
What was it investigating?
Human radiation experiments, but, you know,
right.
This they were a specific group of women, and I've met one or two of them, three of them, I guess.
And do you know if there's any statistics, names, like lists in terms of numbers, names of people, children who are involved in that program and what became of them?
Well, you know, let me think for a second. I mean, people who've researched it and the people who've written about it, there's a number of people, but they estimate it's in the thousands or even tens of thousands or even higher. The numbers of children who actually, you know, went through this. I mean, in one way or another. I mean, back to me, everything in our family just fell apart in 1962. My father was put in the hospital. My mother came down with a galloping case of what they call galloping rheumatoid arthritis. They kept saying the worst case they'd ever seen. Our family just about collapsed. My brother and I were 11, 12 years old, and we sort of lived through this period where both our parents were constantly going in and out of hospital, or at least my mother was constantly going in. My father went in. Yeah, my father went in later for other things, and it would appear that our family was really under attack. This was when I was about 11 or 12. I had hallucinations at night of a voice speaking to me at age 11, telling me, it would just repeat the same phrase hundreds of times in my head. And it was like a voice, an audible voice. And it repeated the same phrase that I found out Dr. Cameron was on one of the recordings, that Dr. Cameron, who was one of his techniques, was to play tapes.
Yeah.
Of repeated phrases around over and over, instructions and things to his patients. Well, I found it verbatim. I mean, I know exactly what the voice said to me hundreds of times. It said, "You're no good. You will fail. You will never succeed at anything." And that played in my head for, you know, for a few months.
Wow.
At night. And I would have, but it would begin with a feeling of, I can say, getting off on acid is what, you know, a strange physical sensations. I would feel myself like Alice in Wonderland, getting big, getting tiny, you know, growing, filling the room, becoming the size of a pea, auditory hallucinations, you know, everything would become distorted. And as if I were getting off on something like LSD, then the voice would kick in. Now, I don't know what that was, but in his 50s, I asked my brother about it. He said, "Oh, that was happening to me too, but I never talked about it." And I said, "Well, I never talked about it either. I didn't want to upset my parents. You know, they had enough that they were coping with. I didn't want to tell them I'm hearing a voice at night." And, you know, and so that was kind of the climax of a few months later. My father retired from teaching because he couldn't teach anymore. I mean, they basically destroyed his memory. They kept him in the island over Christmas vacation and over the winter of December, January 1962, 63, right after the Cuban missile crisis, right? And then by June, he took early retirement. He was 60. My parents were older. We took a trip across Canada. And during that same summer, Dr. Cameron was fired and left Montreal. I never heard the voice again. I remember the last time I heard the voice was in June of 1963, which was around the, you know, and I never heard it after. Well, that was the summer that Dr. Cameron, his project was dismantled and he left town.
Wow.
And yeah.
So you would have been 12.
Yeah, at that point I was 12. And so after that, it was mainly, our family was trying to repair itself. I had two sick parents. Well, father retired, not earning very much money. Mother with a terrible destructive illness that, you know, just devastated her over the next 10 years. My brother and I, you know, trying to be normal. And you don't understand the causes of any of these things. I mean, I had no idea that my father was a Cameron patient or, you know, what that would mean, you know, by 1977, like 15 years later. You know, and he died in 1974, so, you know, he was dead when I had it. You know, I could never ask him, what happened to you? You know, I tried to ask him, he didn't want to talk about it. But he, you know, after he came out of the hospital in 1963, I said, so Dad, like, you know, what's going on? And he says, well, I can tell you one thing, they're not doing anything good down at that hospital. And I said, oh, well, you know, they were just trying to help you. And they weren't trying to help anybody. He said, you know, they put me in group therapy. I wouldn't tell them anything. And he was so cynical about it. And I thought, well, psychiatrists are good people, you know, they're therapists. And no, he wouldn't, you know, he didn't want to talk about it. It was as if there was a, you know, there was a black hole in my family history, in my memory, a feeling like my parents were never the same. They both were dead by the time I was 30. My father died when I was 23, you know, and then my mother was died when I was 28.
Mm-hmm. So how old were you when you met Leonard Cohen?
26. My mother was still alive, and I had just left her in the care of someone else, and she was all right. She was, you know, and I had moved back downtown to the old neighborhood where I'd, you know, hung out with the artists, and it was 1977.
1977, which is when the revelations came out about you and Cameron. So was it before or after that you met Cohen?
It was the very month. I mean, I don't know, just coincidence or something, but the revelations of Cameron came out, I believe, in August or July of 1977. I moved downtown, and the first thing that started happening was everywhere I went, I bumped into Leonard Cohen.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any interest in him at that point, musically?
I didn't like him very much, but I found him fascinating. I'd been to a concert of his in 1975 when I was living in Hamilton, which was just around the time my father died, and, you know, when my mother came to live with me. Well, anyway, two or three years before I actually met him, I'd finally gone to a concert expecting nothing. Expecting it to be, I brought some friends with me, and I said, well, I'm going, let's go. He's from Montreal, I'm nostalgic, and it's probably going to be really boring. And he put the whole audience into a deep trance, and we came out of the concert, and it was a very high quality concert. You know how he can be pretty impressive on stage. I had no idea it was going to be that good. But also we went home to someone's house and stayed up talking about how he'd hypnotized us. And how had he done that? We knew it, you know. And so that was 75. In 77, he was just suddenly he'd appeared. Well, I had just reappeared on the streets, but I was actually living across the street from him. And I'd found an apartment, I'd moved in, and wait, I've got the sequence a bit mixed up. There are two different apartments, but never mind. I was back in the neighborhood. I always was living within a couple of blocks of him without knowing that he lived there. And but this time he happened to be in town in 77, September, I signed the lease and on my apartment and started being there. And there he was. He was always on the street. I'd run into him. He'd try to talk to me because he liked to talk to young women, you know, tall young women.
Yeah.
And I just kept walking. I didn't want to talk to him.
Huh.
So that's how it began. And by November, I'd run into him about five times, and I had a friend who worked for him, a carpenter who was his carpenter. He was renovating some buildings for him, and he said, "I'll introduce you to him if you want. You know, I mean, I'm sure he'd like to meet you." So as he gave him my phone number, and I got a phone call from Leonard Cohen one night, and that's how I met him in early November of 77. And, you know, just one of those things, or I don't know. I tend to think it wasn't just one of those things.
So just rewinding a little bit, when you heard about Ewan Cameron in August 77, did it affect you?
Well, first thing I wondered was, what they were doing was they were showcasing the worst victims in the newspapers. They had kind of weekly articles about horrific cases of people being turned into vegetables. And of course, what that does, it makes you think, is, well, my dad was not a vegetable. My dad went on teaching for the rest of the year before retiring, you know. My dad was able to function. I mean, he was a little bit amnesiac. He wasn't looking too good when he got out, but he recovered. My family are not among the victims, because the victims, as they were being presented to us, were, you know,
extreme.
That was done for a reason, because they wanted that to happen, because otherwise there were thousands of victims, frankly, in Montreal. That's my impression, because even today I can't walk down the street and talk to a stranger, or meet anybody. They've always got a relative that was harmed. I mean, it's just kind of a given fact of life in Montreal. And yet no one seems to know, you know. That's how powerful the media are.
Hmm.
And the media owners invested in the research. They're totally complicit, because they were making money. I mean, they were putting money into it. They wanted mind control. You know, that's their business. Media, newspaper publishers were very interested, and they made massive donations.
Mm-hmm.
To the institutions that were doing these experiments. So there's no, you know, and the law firms, McGill's law firm is the same as the Gazette, Montreal Gazette's law firm, Crooked. Brian Mulroney's in it, you know. I mean, It's a very small little world, and it's easy to control.
Okay, so that's going macro, so let's go micro again. Yeah.
Sorry.
It's all right. So you met Leonard. He called you up on the telephone. I mean, there's all kinds of speculation we could do here, but I'm resisting the temptation. I think the facts can speak for themselves, is what I feel. I mean, it's just so compelling and undeniable, to me at least, what you're describing and the implications of it. So for now, anyway, let's just keep to the facts as you remember them. So you'd seen her around town. I actually read this, and this was how I first became aware of you, in the Geist article, these weird kind of random encounters that you kept having with him.
Over about, you know, it was 7 years. The first time I'd seen him was on the night that Pierre Laporte, anyway, was murdered in the rain. The FLQ crisis was in full swing, and the next day martial law was declared. And that's the night that I met Leonard Cohen for the first time on the street.
What year was that?
And he wrote 1970, October. October, I figure, I looked at it, I think it was a Friday night, I was out going to the bar or something, and it was raining, and I think it was the 17th of October. Anyway, I've narrowed it down. I'm pretty sure it was the night that Pierre Laporte was killed, but we didn't know yet.
Okay.
And then he was driving up the street, and he rolled down his window and said, and sort of just looked at me, and I said, I know who you are. I was just, you know, drenched in the rain, you know, standing on the corner. And he said, and I know who you are. And that was, so, right. You know, that was the first encounter.
And you were 19 then.
Yeah.
And he was already a celebrity at that point.
Oh, yeah, very, very recognizable, you know.
Yeah.
1970.
So, sure. And did that have any effect on you when he said, I know who you are?
Oh, yeah, it sort of threw me. And I mean, you know, I said, but why? That's what I said back to him. Why?
Yeah.
And he just rolled up the window and drove off. Well, the light changed and he took off. I think he was with Suzanne, his wife. Well, he was with a beautiful dark-haired
mother of
woman.
His children,
anyway,
yeah.
I'm not saying he knew who I was when he saw me on the street. But I didn't get to this, but I think I knew him from the Allen Memorial from the when I was a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I've come to that belief, and when I came as an intuition, and someone else told me, someone else saw it, someone else told me a few years ago. Someone said, "I just had this dream," and he told, and you know, you were a little girl in the Allen Memorial, and he didn't really know these circumstances, right? And Leonard Cohen was there; he was a mental patient, and the doctors were doing a procedure on you. And it was potentially lethal. Well, I've had flashbacks. Actually, you know, in recent years, I'd already had a flashback to that. But my friend who had this dream knew nothing of that. And I did have I believe that that did happen. They electroshocked me. I mean, I had a physical memory of it one time, of shooting in the air. I mean, I lifted off the bed where I was having this flashback. And the doctors were standing around in white coats, talking about me. I was 4 years old, and they said, well, you know, in some cases when you do this, the heart stops and doesn't, you know, stops for good, so this is very delicate, you know. And then they did this thing and my heart did stop, and then it started again, and I was a four-year-old girl. So I'd had a flash, this was a flashback that I'd had. Now, it would have happened about 1955, right? And I looked and I checked, and Leonard Cohen was in the Allen in 1955, in 1958-59, when I think also spent time there.
You checked out how?
I checked out through the biographies and following up some, yeah, just information. It just happens to be in the Sylvie Simmons biography about the 1958-59. He spent quite a bit of time in the Allen.
And what was the ostensible reason?
Well, you know, she kind of soft-pedals it, but I think she quotes his friends, and I think it's she's the one. You know, people were saying he's gone nuts. He's not doing well. He was acting very strangely. He was starting to give poetry readings downtown, but he was also behaving in a way that made people think he was really mentally ill. I think there was some violence, something about violent behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, it got, I think, something that was disturbing enough. He wasn't just being neurotic, you know. And so he spent some time there, and he lived at that time, I think, or maybe it was a bit later, he lived just a few doors down on Pine Avenue in Montreal. You know, he was living next door to the island for a while.
And how old were you when this friend told you about this dream that he'd had?
Well, that was just a few years ago, two, three years ago.
So,
you know, he described the circumstances, and he didn't know. He said there was this lethal procedure and these doctors, and I'd had I'd had a flashback, but a very vivid one about 10 years ago, so earlier on. Mm. And it was exactly that. And so he said, and Leonard Cohen was a mental patient, and he walked into the room and he stopped them. Mm-hmm. He prevented it from happening. That's what he said to me. He said, that's why Leonard Cohen is in your life. Mm. It goes back to that. And, he certainly treated me when I did meet him in 1977, I mean, face-to-face at his house.
Yeah.
He treated me like a long-lost friend. That was what was so baffling. He made me a member of his circle instantly.
Mm-hmm.
Once, you know, we got through our initial verbal sparring at the kitchen table, and, you know, and I kind of calmed down, and I was, you know, by the end of the evening, I mean, you know, he had invited me into his life to be any time.
What were you sparring about?
Well, I didn't really like him. He called me up, you know, there'd been all those times when I could have met him and I didn't, because I didn't like the look of him. I didn't like, you know, didn't like what I'd heard. Thought he was a misogynist. You know, I was a young, I was like 26, 20, you know, during those years I was kind of feminine, not exactly a feminist, but sort of, you know. I just didn't like the whole aura around him very much, but I did find him fascinating. And I thought he was dangerous, you know, so I got to his, when he phoned me up, he said, come over, you know. It was 9 o'clock at night. I put on my sneakers, I ran over, and he let me in, and my idea was, well, I'm only going to stay about an hour, and he's not going to like me. I'm not going to like him. He's not going to like me, but I'm going to have had this encounter, you know, because we're not going to agree on anything, and I'm going to make that clear to him. You know, that was my idea, but not in an aggressive way, but I just was going to really keep my wits about me. And, you know, by the end of the evening, I mean, I didn't go home.
Mm. You know? So would you say that he seduced you?
Mildly, you know.
I mean, was it that caused
In the middle of a very awkward conversation that I could see he was finding rather painful and disappointing. I don't know what he expected, but it's as if he expected something. And in the middle of that, it's as if suddenly I said something, it was a bit, you know, he said something back to me, and I suddenly felt really ashamed of myself
mm-hmm.
for being arrogant or something, being the way I was. And as a light switched on, like his everything he saw that I felt, you know, and how I felt, and suddenly we became real, you know, and suddenly there was a lot in common on some level, an emotional, something just came on that felt 100% real. And I felt I was looking at someone that was, you know, badly misunderstood, had to maintain this image, was, you know, who I had judged, you know, prejudged without knowing him, that I was, you know, very superficial in my judgment, and that he was worth getting to know. And he opened up and he became very warm in a very genuine way. And so, you know, what can I say? I mean, I was kind of swept along in it. Plus, it also had a little extra element of some, I don't want to say, some very powerful energy, you know.
Hmm.
Sort of seemed to suddenly be released. And I'm not saying sexual, even sexual energy. It really wasn't. It was more some kind of spiritual, you know, energy. And I started to take him seriously from that point on.
Part two of this conversation is available now at the same page that you downloaded or listened to this first part. Parts three and four will be available online at horticulture.com/limitless on Wednesday the 16th of September. There are links in the show notes to relevant material regarding the subject matter discussed in these podcasts.
You can mess with my life in a poor one, have me divorced by the time of the chorus. There's no need to change any sentence when you always decide where I go next. Many nights you would hide from the audience, and they were not in tune with your progress. In the end, you're a fool like the journalist who turns what you sing into business. You could use to be more like a hero, a dark shade of damage distortion, wearing death like a cape or a costume. Cut your ties and leave town when you want to, killing time till I pass to the chamber of the room where you keep my replacement. So fed up, still you're starving on paper. You know him, but he's you only bitter. Damage. I could use the ledge to jump off of. I wasn't lying when I said this was over. I have questions that lead to more questions. Run a tide that will cut off my fingers. You wrote about me on every new record, and I'll show up in a title of your song. I only hope somebody requests it. For you in Washington, I've only seen photos of Washington. I'll never know. Leave me Manhattan, I want the evergreens. Write me a song I can sing in my sleep. As sure as the rain that will fall where you stand, I want you in the skyline. These are my demands. What's it like for you in Washington? I've only seen photos of Washington. I'll never know.